Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of CCYSE Awaaz. For those of you listening to us for the first time, CCYSE is the Critical Childhoods and Youth Studies Collective. We are a collective of academicians and practitioners working on and with young people in South Asia. I'm Suchismita. I'm currently a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology at the Graduate Institute, Geneva. My PhD is in ethnography of personality development in other grooming schools in Delhi. I look at how aspirations and desires of young people are realized by such institutes. Today we have with us Paromita Vohra. She's a filmmaker, a writer, and the founder of Agents of Ishq, which is a multimedia project about sex, love, and desire presented to you in the most fun manner. Actually, the AOI tagline is something I think that says it better than any of these introductions, which is we give sex a good name. Paromita is also a filmmaker. Some of her documentaries are Cosmopolis, Two Tales of a City, Girls and Morality TV, and The Loving Jihad, Ek Manohar Kahani, Where Sandra, and Unlimited Girls. She also regularly writes for various magazines and newspapers on gender, popular culture, and urban life. You can find her weekly column, Paranormal Activity, in the Sunday edition of Midday. Welcome, Paromita. Welcome to CCYSE Awaaz.
Thank you for doing this
on the first day of your vacation.
My pleasure.
So let's begin with the Agents of Ishq before we move on to some other topics that you write and talk about. But firstly, congratulations on 5 years of Agents of Ishq.
Thank you.
If you'd like to, so we would like to begin by maybe you could tell us a little about how Agents of Ishq began and what was your experience of putting it all together. And also, I'm more curious about one thing, which is the name. Why Agents of Ishq?
So when Agents of Ishq, well, as you know, it's 5 years old. So we started working on it in early 2015, maybe even late 2014. I don't remember exactly. But the project went live in 2015, December. The context for starting it was that I think, you know, sex, pleasure, desire, they have been intertwined with the work that I did as a lens, sometimes as a topic, but never quite as frontally as with Agents of Ishq. But it has always been a prism through which I tried to understand things. And at the time, you know, it was a couple of years after the gang rape in Delhi. So one of the things that had been happening is that we were talking about sexual violence for the first time, much more prominently in the public space. And you know, news which used to be stuck in some corner of the paper was now on the front page. So overtly, it seemed to be a very good thing that we were talking about these things. And at the same time, I felt as if the conversation around sexual violence was also re-inscribing some notions of morality and some notions of fragility for women and the idea that the public space is very dangerous for women. They should not go out there and that they need to be protected by men of basically their caste and class. But all of this was, of course, not being said overtly. It was being said sometimes with the best of intentions. So you had a lot of projects like He for She, or, you know, the Real Mard project. So also certain notions of masculinity and femininity were being reinscribed. But I think what used to trouble me a lot was really the way in which questions of caste and class used to get interwoven. And the questions of morality were not simply those of, you know, keeping women at home or always talking about the public space in a binary, which is either we want to reclaim it for pleasure and, you know, being flaneurs and so on and so forth, which always seemed to be a slightly squeaky clean kind of idea of how we should inhabit public space. And the second thing is that that the public space is a dangerous space for women. But all of it, of course, also reinscribes a larger idea that our idea of progress should be being able to be in public space. So women's progress is to be in the form of whatever men have right now, assuming that what men have is ideal for men or the rest of the world, right? So there was this kind of a thing happening in there. And, you know, I've always been, loved the internet, and a lot of my own creative language really flowered with finding the internet in a sense. So there were a lot of new spaces that were opening up. You know, social media was enabling the promotion of a kind of content that was not mainstream. But in that too, I would find, again, this sort of an idea endorsed. And my favorite example of that is the Creep Kavali, which was a kind of a music video by AIP about how there's a creep in the other inbox. And, you know, it was a very classic example of what used to trouble me, which is like, it's very entertaining, it's very nicely made, and it seems to have these really good intentions. But there is a morality of which kind of boys you're supposed to talk to and not talk to. So it's assumed that the guy who can't speak English properly is a creep, because he can't speak English properly, therefore he has written to you in your other's inbox. So what happens if he's a really suave guy and shares your politics? Is that okay? And I think all of that used to trouble me a lot, right? This mocking of people who say friendship instead of friendship. So the pretense of caring about women is often a sort of cover for respectability. We know that historically. And I really could feel that was happening around me all the time. And it was frustrating me. And at the same time, I was creatively curious about doing something online. So the two things sort of came together, also because sex education got banned in 13 states. And there was a lot of talk about how we should not be talking about these things. Nuke, I don't think the questions of moral policing or questions about morality are new, to be honest, but they were just resurfacing in a different way. So at the time, I mean, now looking back, it seems like, how did we think we could do such a thing? But perhaps already the past always seems more innocent than the present. And at the time, just 5 or 6 years ago, the internet was not as constrained by corporate ownership as it is today. And so it seems so possible to think that, you know, we can also do something. We'll do something on the internet. The internet is the home of sex. People go to the internet to look for porn. They go to talk, to meet people, to date, to find others. So I think we should be on the internet, and we should not be doing this project elsewhere. And that is how Agents of Ishq was, you know, dreamed up in this not a very systematic way, but through a kind of reaction to what was the mainstream discourse around sex and sexuality. And I think to answer your question about how the name came about, Agents of Ishq, you know, I think when we did the research, an interesting thing emerged, and I had also been sensing it for a while because I used to write a column on modern love. So I used to talk to a lot of people about their intimate lives. And classically, we know that the idea of shame surrounds sex and the body, and that people have had shame because they think about sex, or the world of sex is shrouded in shame. But I think the other thing that we have been discovering in the last few years, and the work on Agents of Ishq, of course, has underlined that a lot for us, was that people were also feeling another kind of shame in parallel, which was about being uncool. Which is like, everybody's supposed to be now, you know, every few months there would be an article in the magazine saying, there's a sexual revolution happening in India. And, you know, the number of times a sexual revolution has happened in India in the last 20 years, I can testify to, because I keep getting asked to write articles about it. And I'm like, oh, has it come yet? Has it come yet? Didn't it come last year? So there is this kind of a surrounding idea of a sexual revolution, which defines sexual revolution in one way only, you know, and it's very much in the old definition of how men are supposed to be cool and virile because they always want to have sex and they can always have sex and so on. And so everything is then put into that mold of what is an idealized sexual life. And of course, there's dating apps which are growing, which were still 5 years ago, a little shadowy. People didn't admit to it so easily as they do now. But there was indeed a big shift occurring. Of course, the internet had changed a lot. So people were dating and there was a new sexual openness. But it's not like everybody catches up overnight with change, right? So there was a kind of accompanying sense of shame if you were not part of that kind of a scene, or if you did not feel casually about sex, then you were ashamed of it. And there was one more kind of shame alongside it, which was intertwined, that if you had feelings, then that is shameful. It's not cool to have feelings. It's not cool to fall in love. Everything's supposed to be no strings attached. So it was, I mean, I think that there was a binary. There's always been a binary in which it operates, right? Earlier we were told that love is superior and sex is something base. Now we are told love is something foolish and old fashioned. And, you know, being casual about sex is the real way to be. But in fact, like everything else, there are many truths, and it's a spectrum of feelings and desires, and love and sex and desire are intertwined. And so it seemed to me that this was a fruitless discussion, and it was just creating layer upon layer upon layer of shame rather than actually opening things out. And there was a huge amount of ignorance inside that shame, right? Because if you're supposed to be cool and you're always acting cool, you're pretending that you know, but you don't actually know most things. And the only knowledge you're getting is through pornography, which is a limited kind of knowledge. And I mean, I say this very often, that it's fine, pornography, in the absence of anything else, at least there's pornography. So it's not like people are going to their wedding nights with no idea what's supposed to happen. But the thing is, learning about sex from pornography is like learning about love from Yashraj films. You know? It's entertainment and it's a suggestion for something, but it's not actually information in a way that's going to help you. So I think, you know, all of this made me feel that the frame that we should use, how to find an inclusive frame to talk about these things, how not to end up being prescriptive in the way that the idea that, oh, you should be sexually free and being sexually free means only one thing. How do you break that binary? That's the most important thing. And desire is a much more inclusive frame, because desires can be plentiful. And ishq means desire. But the term agents of ishq, the phrase agents of ishq, arose in a far more frivolous way, which is to say, we kept saying that we want to have, like, maybe it could be called the ishq project, and ishq would be an acronym for Indian Sex Headquarters. And this kind of joking was going on when we were talking about the name. And then we were like, and then everybody will be like little agents of these headquarters. And then as soon as we said it, we thought, well, agents of ishq is the correct name. Also, because it overturns this, you know, very pious usage of the term agency.
Yes.
Because everybody is supposed to be an agent of change, and you're supposed to have agency. But it too has become a bit of jargon, right? And that doesn't mean that the word isn't important or the idea that it represents is not important, but these terms become kind of deadened because they get so overused and we never talk about what they mean. Everybody assumes that we know what it means. So the real discussion which must take place, what is agency for you? Is it different for me than it is for you? Never happens, that discussion. And it is the same for desire. It is assumed that only one kind of desire is the desire to aspire for. So the idea that we can open up and make inclusive the conversation around sex seemed to be very important as a way of breaking this hold of shame and the binary of shame and prescription within which most of us operate in almost all domains. All political and cultural domains seem to push towards those poles. So really the effort was to not be in those poles, but to be somewhere which was much more unmoderated, where a number of people could enter. If you recognize that people who are very sexually active are also pretty ignorant and carry a lot of different types of shame, and people who've never had sex and don't know much about it also carry shame, then how to create something that would allow all of these people to come to the same place? So that is why the idea of desire, which is sometimes love for somebody and sex for somebody, which is heterosexual for someone, asexual, homosexual, pansexual, everything. I mean, it just allowed everything to enter the space, you know, and it made it very capacious. So that is how
is interesting, and what I really like about, because I have been following Agents of ishq, I think, for actually pretty much when it started. And just to kind of go back to your earlier interests, which was this, that, you know, so I saw Where's Sandra in college, and then I saw Girls Unlimited when I was in university, and then I think later Agents of ishq happened, and I followed the site. And about 3-4 days back, I rewatched both Where's Sandra and Girls Unlimited, because I really like those two movies of yours.
Thank you.
I also see a sort of a continuation where in Where's Sandra, the idea is this person who's seeking pleasure, right? There is the figure, and so the pleasure that she's always, you know, she embodies. And even in Girls Unlimited, through the discussion of feminism, one is also struggling to answer or discuss questions of pleasure. So in a way, I mean, I think Agents of ishq, sort of the way it foregrounds pleasure, it becomes, as you're very rightly saying, it kind of goes beyond the boundaries of these binaries that you're talking about. Because when I was growing up, like, we didn't have, you know, I didn't have any sex education growing up in Trivandrum. And my parents just assumed that reading Femina, Agony Auntie by Zina Qamar, that, you know, just there was no censorship.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of, well, none of us had it. Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, there was no censorship in terms of the kind of books you could read, but there was no conversation. So you just picked up from Sidney Sheldon and Harold Robbins, what is actually happening. But the thing was, like, there was always a shame, as you're rightly saying, of, oh, I mean, you know, if I have sex, I can't talk about it. A shift in the last 10 years where there is a compulsion to be that you are possibly, you're pretty much uncool if you have not done or if you have not engaged. So in that sense, when suddenly when Agents of Ish is foregrounding not sex as much as desire and pleasure, as that is, then it can be where you're pleasuring yourself. Like, that also becomes very important. And then, you know, because you can be having sex and you may not know how to pleasure yourself. Like, you may not know the idea of pleasure. So in that sense, I was thinking that in a way, this also changes our understanding of our bodies, right? When you don't talk about identities of sexuality, when you don't talk about homo, hetero, pan, whatever, but you're solely focusing on pleasure, it also changes possibly how you even view yourself.
I mean, I would say that whether it is a film about feminism or whether it is Agents of Ishq, which is a sex education site in the broadest sense of the term, it's all about a relationship with yourself. It's all about reclaiming the ability to understand what you want and to be able to somehow enact that or aspire to that in the world in relationship to other people as well, right? I mean, because yes, ideas of consent are very important. It's not only about your own pleasure, but about how do you coexist with others? How can you enact your desires in coexistence with the rest of the world? And that's a central question of existence in the end, isn't it? How can I be me in relationship to the rest of the world? So I think in that sense, I feel disappointed that there aren't more such things. But one of the things that I feel that pleasure, even the idea of pleasure, you know, is always looked on with suspicion. So when I made Unlimited Girls, for example, one of the things about Unlimited Girls that was, that set it apart from a large number of, not all, because, you know, I've seen documentaries which gave me a lot of pleasure, but the idea of pleasure in the documentary or the idea of pleasure in political conversation did not exist. There was a binary that if you're serious, you're ascetic, you know, everything is plain and you're not going to be so frivolous like movies which have songs in them. And this binary of the political and the intellectual, the pleasurable and the bodily, which you already see in films, in what is called art cinema versus not art cinema. I don't know how they make that binary, right? Because, I mean, all commercial cinema is seen. Yeah. So there are, these binaries operate everywhere, right? So when I made Unlimited Girls, I mean, that was a very pleasurable film. Even its starting point was just like a girl reading a Milson Boone and her heart, glass heart hanging in the windowsill. And there was a kind of, I made that film, I was 30 when I made that film, and it was very much made out of the material of my own life, right? Which is to say, not, I mean, that was the other thing which I was rebelling against in Unlimited Girls, and I still don't like so much, which is that, you know, you speak about your own self confessionally rather than speak about your own self in a poetic fashion. And I think Unlimited Girls in that way was searching for that language, that I wanted to speak about what I had learned by living and working for 10 years as a feminist, young feminist woman in the city, all that it had comprised of, chat rooms and yellow nail polish and living on my own in my house and thinking about politics and trying to learn about new things. All of that was in one place. They were not in two separate boxes. And the film was striving for a form that would bring all of these things in. Where Sandra, actually I have a great story about it, which was that it was shown in some film festival. And people were upset because they said, it's a documentary, it's not a very serious, it's not really a political film, is it? Because it's too much fun. So I once ran into a film critic who has been a jury member often on the street. And we took a bus ride together. And he said, oh, you know, you're the only filmmaker whom I really like because everybody else's films are so boring. And, you know, because at that time I was young and a bit more pugnacious. I said, really, if you think my films are so good, how come you never give them any prizes when you're in juries? And he looked very guilty for a second. I mean, which was quite unfair to put him on the spot like that, because now he couldn't tell me we don't give them a prize because we just don't think they're good enough. So, but then he said this thing which stayed in my mind, that you know, it's because your films are just too much fun.
And we can't be seen to give a prize to some documentary. Like,
I think that there is when something is pleasurable, the onus is on you. You have to take responsibility for your pleasure. You have to say, I like this and I believe in this thing. So I want to endorse it. And I think traditionally, we have not seen the world do that. You know, I mean, there is a reason why courtesans and tawaifs and the entire world of pleasure exists in a shadowy space, because it doesn't fit into the binary. It's always breaking the binary. Pleasure is so nebulous. It is so hard to define that it becomes hard to control. And that is why most people don't prefer to work with the business of pleasure, in a sense. And what you do find is that people much more easily will go along with an absolute statement. Even social media demonstrates that, you know, all these, we can see the difference between what people are saying in when they respond to Agents of Ishq, and the same people might be saying about the opposite thing on Twitter, because that is the trending political expression you're supposed to follow. So when it comes to making an absolute statement, people feel safer. They feel it's unambiguous. They feel many people are saying it, so they will go with it, right? So the idea even of having such a strong relationship with yourself that you're able to say that I don't care if nobody else thinks this way, but I really feel this way for myself and I am going to do it. It's rare to find that. There are two places in which you find it. You find that amongst artists, and you find that within sexuality and desire. Eventually, when you think of all the, you know, recently a young woman said that she was really upset that films did not represent a range of sexualities, because she never realized she was probably bisexual until she started watching some kind of content online about it. And I wanted to say, how do you think all the people who are openly queer, who have led movements or who've at least lived queer lives openly, how do you think they arrived at it? You know, they saw little something in a movie somewhere and they responded to it. Like, nobody was telling you that just because in the movie a man and a woman were attracted to each other, that you were compelled to feel that. I mean, if you as a woman felt attracted to the woman on screen, you need a certain belief in that desire, or that desire overcomes you. The human mind's capacity to inform you of its desires is huge. Your ability to believe in that and go with it is constrained by a large number of things. So I feel that in that sense, pleasure is a very volatile, powerful, scary thing for people. And they always downgrade it a bit and say, it's not that important. I mean, one can't really take it that seriously. So the idea that in order to be taken seriously, you must look serious. And that if you are not looking serious, then you are not serious. It's literal minded. Now, when I say it like this, it's embarrassing if you think that way. But unfortunately, the majority of the world does think that way and act on that, right? So it also, I mean, from Unlimited Girls to now, the idea that if I'm going to talk about freedom, I can't do that in a form that's not free, is what I felt talking about Unlimited Girls. If I'm going to talk about where Sandra and say that there are stereotypes of Catholic women that operate in the world, My response can't be to say you're wrong because you're stereotyping, because that's just scolding people, right? I mean, in Unlimited Lines, in Unlimited Girls, there's a line that you can't change people by scolding them in groups. And I do believe that. The thing is that maybe you saw the Catholic teacher and thought, or a dull and dowdy religious girl. For me, Paromita, those were the women who I thought, like, wow, they're so glamorous. Oh, wow. In the movie, they are never crying. They're always having a good time. I want to be like them. I don't want to be like this heroine who's always crying, right? So the thing is, I felt that I would rather show you how I saw them than contradict your view. I'm not really interested in your view of it. I'm interested in seeing what I've seen, right? So therefore, this kind of ping pong of I feel this, no, you're wrong, let me prove to you why you're wrong, which is that, you know, St. Stephen's Debating Society form of political conversation. I'm like not at all interested in that. You know, I'm not a guy, thankfully. So I am free to have other forms of discourse. And that is what I seek to create in all the work that I do. For me, I'm interested in how people think and how can we make the act of thinking pleasurable so that we're not scared to think. Essentially, we are scared to think because we feel it's too scary to think something through to another end than the end we're supposed to go towards. So it is actually to make the act of thinking, feeling, ruminating, changing your mind pleasurable and all right, that I make the work that I make. And so, of course, yes, from Unlimited Girls to Agents of Ishq, there is a straight line, because in the end, Agents of Ishq is a project in which I feel you can't talk about pleasure if the space is not pleasurable. I mean, look at the spaces in which we encounter sex. Pornography may have some direct, you know, erogenous impact on people, of course, but it's not usually beautiful, or, I mean, we encounter sex in not always multiply beautiful spaces, right? And the idea was also that we will create a world that is so beautiful and friendly and fun, and it's a bit naughty, but it's also extremely emotional. It's everything that life is, and we'll make that a world of sex, a universe of sex. And that's why also a lot of our imagery is about like space, not space, but like mythical space, no? Like yeah. Celestial creatures in a way, the moon and people looking at each other. So there is a lot of that kind of idea, even in the way that Agents of Ishq is shaped.
So tell me something about, you know, the visuals of the aesthetics of Agents of Ishq, because I'm sure there must be some kind of, like, what was, there must be some kind of research that must have gone into sort of, you know, doing the primers that you do, or mm-hmm. for that matter, I mean, more attractive is, I would say, the language that you use, which is, mm-hmm. you know, like what I say, I mean, a lot of people would say is very namkeen. Like there is, mm-hmm. you know, these Bollywood references that you have, mm-hmm. and it's bilingual. There's so much of Hindi and English playfully interacting with each other, and, you know, your trademark Yaniki, which you use in a lot of places. And generally, like, you know, there is a very seamless way in which there's Bollywood references coming in. And often Bollywood is used as a language to talk about desire and you know, sex. And so I was, I mean, can you tell me a little bit more about just the aesthetics of Agents of Ishq, which makes it so approachable? You know?
So, I mean, you know, for Agents of Ishq, the research that we did was not so much aesthetic, but we did spend some time talking to people. We did some workshops in colleges to try to understand what young people are thinking about, what would they like from a site of this kind. And not always taking them at face value. Like, we did this method where we would ask them questions and they would respond, but we would also ask them to write it down and give it to us anonymously on chits. And we usually found like a 90%, it was the opposite of what they'd said, right, in the chits. So like, you would ask them, so what do you think about the fact that relationships and dating are so casual? And then everybody would say, it's great, it's so much fun, you have choices. And all the chits would be like, why do boys behave so meanly? Why do they ghost on you? You know, so there was a, so we saw, that's how we understood the degree of the shame and saying what you really feel. But I think most of our research really showed us that A, there was an absence of Indian material, right? All the material that was being used was Americanized. And that was a very big problem because, I mean, again, I have said this before, but this, I was very alarmed when I saw that sites like BuzzFeed and ScoopWhoop, these like popular sites, were all using terminology like vajayjay and coochie. And I would just be like, is it for real? Like, do people really talk like that? Have I grown so old that I don't know? Because, you know, I've always found it very difficult that people say flip-flops for Hawaii chappal, right? And I feel that's a generational divide, that there is a generation that says flip-flops. And I'm like, you mean Hawaii chappal, right? That's what you mean. So
I would say the word maps. I grew up saying maths, and suddenly there's like, oh, math. And you're like, where, what?
So many terms, you know, like second standard became second grade. And so the Americanisms that set in, now they are around us. So you're like, maybe people really talk like that. But what you do come to understand is people are just borrowing that language from another space, right? And then there's no real language to talk about these things. And there's no culturally situated language. And by culturally, I don't just mean Hindi, English, Bollywood, etc. I just mean that the way that we live in India, first of all, the big difference is that people live with their families till they are like 75 sometimes, right? So it's a completely different world. And our intimacies are very different. The way that we are physical with each other without sex is also very different, you know? So I just feel like language has to describe experience. And if you're using a language that doesn't incorporate and integrate the experience you're having, is not rooted in that experience, then the language is doing you damage. It's not actually helping you to express yourself. So it was very understandable early on that what our task is really to create a new language to talk about things that are otherwise tabooed or feel uncomfortable. We also saw that language was the issue even for people who are doing sex education work, right? Like within adolescent sexuality programs and other spaces. We went in, one of the places where we went for research was an adolescent sexuality workshop, and the teachers were teaching and the students were sleeping or doing something else. And I'm like, there's something seriously wrong if in a sex ed class, the kids are not interested. There's something is seriously wrong. And then one organization, we asked them what they're using to teach, and they were showing an excerpt from the Blue Lagoon to talk about attraction. And we like, guys, please, what will happen when the kids grow up and see the actual movie and know what that little scene was about, you know? So I think that we felt that we wanted to also create material that would help people to do their work better, that would help them to have a conversation about subjects that are, of course, they're uncomfortable. None of us grew up talking about these things. And how do you do it in the open? So the material should allow for that to happen. And, you know, I've always felt from Unlimited and earlier Unlimited Girls onwards for sure that actually laughing together, doing things together, like enjoying something together, it creates also an inclusive space. It allows people to talk about the thing they have seen instead of their own selves. I'm very uncomfortable with both the social media tendency as well as the slightly NGOized tendency that puts the onus on people to step up and talk about their private experiences as proof that they have been politicized or radicalized, right? I feel like the biggest task, feminist task ahead of us is creating, and not just a feminist task, it is now the task for the entire world, is the importance of the private space. What is privacy? How should we respect it? How can we actually make privacy a more fertile space, a space where somebody can grow, think, decide for themselves, right? What was the biggest finding about sexual violence? That 98+% of rapes take place through somebody you have known. That means it is the private space that is far more difficult for women than the public space. So I think that in a sense, how can we do things that strengthen our private selves? That's really the question ahead of us. So if we are continuously going to deliver syllabi and curricula and then ask people to demonstrate by talking about their private lives, like, you know, I used to feel sex is bad, but now I think it's good. That's like, you know, I have been born again. Like, you can't ask people to do this. And unfortunately, social change programs are always doing that. They're always putting the onus on the person to prove that you have done your job well by making them pass some kind of a catechism. Like an ideological catechism, right? So, but it's very difficult to not do that, because how do you enumerate what you've done? How do you gauge impact, et cetera, et cetera? So people feel scared. But the thing is, since we were not in that game, we had the freedom to try out something else. And I feel that that's why why do we make art? We make art so that it takes it outside of what's inside us. It puts it out there. And then we talk about that thing, right? It's like a proxy for ourselves. But it gives us a safe space. That's how a safe space is created, where I don't force you to expose yourself if you don't want to. But if you want to, you might. So I think, like, the idea of inclusion, there are multiple forms of inclusion, and identity is only one of those forms. But to create parallel forms of inclusion is very important. So I think the language of Agents of Ishq grew from these concerns. And yes, of course, the Hindi and the English is not mixed because we want to be cool. I mean, it is how people talk, but yes. It's also because there's a lot of people for whom English is not their first language. So it also has to be an English that is not intimidating to them, and which is not Americanized, which is not overly correct. So, you know, it's not 100% kind of correct grammar on Agents of Ishq on purpose, that we keep it just a little bit, you know, like Indianisms, like I had not gone there also, instead of I had not gone there at all, or etc. Like, so these terminologies are retained in the English as well. That makes it a little bit more conversational, and it makes people feel less intimidated. You know, I made a film about toilets called Q2P, in which I interviewed the sanitation officer about this very good looking, clean, usable toilet in Khan Market. And he said this thing: a toilet should not look like a toilet. A poor man looking at this toilet should feel, this is some office or something, it's not for me to go inside. And I thought, wow, the idea that you will create a structure for peeing in, which is something all human beings in the public, anybody in that public space should be able to go into a public toilet, but that you will create a space that feels intimidating to the poor so that they feel this is not for me. what kind of inclusion is that, you know, in your built forms? And I'd say it's the same for language, that to create an inclusive language, you have to let people know that everybody is welcome to come in here. Now, interesting thing that happens is, you know, sometimes we've discovered that people who've been pretty active on Agents of Ish, like commenting often, maybe even drawing for our stories or whatever, would turn out to be right-wing people. Sometimes we'd see them online and be like, oh, he's a right-wing person. But I think that is so radical that there is actually a space in which somebody who's very left liberal and somebody who's right-wing might actually be coming together and speaking of something. Isn't that the dream? The dream is that we should find a space in which we can actually come and see things each from each other's point of view. And so I think it also gives me a kind of political hope that if we really work hard to create languages which don't insist on uniformity, we have a greater hope of heterogeneity, right? I mean, you can't speak in the language of uniformity and then say a world more plural. It's because you're not being plural and you're not inviting plurality. So I think the language then was developed in that way. And the other thing is that, you know, I'm definitely that old internet generation who loved the internet because it was playful, it was random. Nobody came there, uncool people were hanging around on the internet, and it was full of odd little artistic experiments. But now the internet's very, very modular. So if you want to make a website that looks really artistic, you have to pay a lot of money to design that website. Otherwise, websites all are pretty modular now. So how to break that modularity was a question for me, because I didn't want that modularity. I wanted it to be really artistic and look like there are people who are making this, not some kind of technical front, you know. And so then you have to kind of break that game, like you have to game that system in some way. And we decided to have this very handmade look, to have people draw. It's also, you know, because how do you represent? We didn't want to represent the body abstractly. We wanted to actually represent the body. So photographs are not an option. So therefore drawings were a nice way to do it. And things that drawings do is they allow you to represent numerous kinds of bodies. And they create the sense of plurality also, because we don't have only one artist, right? We do some work in-house, but we work with a large number of different artists. We have a visual style sheet, which we share, but essentially artists are interpreting that style sheet. So you get a sense of plurality just from the visuals, because so many different people are drawing for it. So I think that the idea of heterogeneity was very seeded into the website. And, you know, often the videos have names like the Garden of Consent and the Valley of Consent. And I think that I'm very persuaded by this biodiversity idea, the idea that you make like this big garden and in which there are many, many different types of plants and flowers, and some are medicinal and some are pleasurable and, you know, some feed you and some turn you on, all of that. It's kind of woven into the design of Agents of Ish.
Right in the beginning, you were saying, you said some, I mean, something which, and also you brought up the video of the Garden of Consent and the Lavani that you did, the Amorous Adventures. Mm-hmm. What I thought was quite novel about it was this also came out, I think, right after Me Too. And there was...
No, it was before.
Was it before? Okay. But around the same time, because I think it also got amplified after Me Too, the videos, actually a lot of people were sharing it. And one of the things that I thought was that stayed with me was that Me Too, there was so much of, you know, there was so much conversation about consent. And there were so many young people who were coming out and talking about, you know, their experiences. And often when you hear about those experiences, it was not only was it about, yes, sexual harassment, but it was also about what you very rightly talk about in your website is sexual etiquette. It was almost like one did not know this word, sexual etiquette, that there is a way in which you have to conduct yourself. Now that seemed so absent. And then to go back to the videos, which was talking about not just a yes means yes and no means no, but there is also the whole in-between part where, you know, where the lovely performance is asking, did he get my point? And then you think, no, he did not get my point, like the last bit. So I was thinking that, would you like to elaborate a little bit on, you know, sexual etiquette? Like, because it also makes an entire difference in the discourse of sex. Because earlier, as you say, the sex ed manuals, you know, the way we talk about sex is always in the form of do's and don'ts. Like, you do not do this, you do this. Like, this is the way to behave. There's bad touch, there's good touch. There's an entire discourse already there. But etiquette sort of expands and takes it beyond sex, right? It takes it beyond the act. And it also involves a very tricky concept of consent. And a lot of young people, I mean, not just young people, I mean, it is, I think, anybody who's in a relationship, there is something that one needs to learn about etiquette there. So would you like to elaborate a little bit on why, I mean, how you came up with, I think, the word sexual etiquette itself?
Yeah, so I think, you know, of course, consent. I mean, I think we're lucky that we made the Lavani before Me Too, because making it after Me Too would have been a loaded environment where you're much more unsure. You know, I mean, the playfulness of the Lavani also comes from a time where these issues are not that much being discussed. But, I mean, it will be evident to people who are listening that I'm a very irritable person, because even the consent Lavani was made out of irritation with the consent is like a cup of tea. Which was a video that was very popular. And even today, people send it to me because they somehow believe I would not have seen it after so many years of doing this work. But I know that it's a very useful piece of work to lay down some basics. But I also do think that sex is not like tea. The primary reason being that if I'm compelled to drink a cup of tea for any reason, it doesn't really harm me. But if I'm forced to have sex against my wishes, that does harm me, and it violates something much bigger. And yet, how to talk about this in a livable way? That's very important for me. That, like, I think I'm very interested in being helpful. So I don't like, you know, I don't like to be bored. I hate it if people bore me. I can't bear it. And I'm very fearful that I'm boring somebody else when I'm talking or making work. And I think that's just good manners. Good manners helps a lot to navigate all of these spaces, right? So I think when we made the consent Lavani, I wanted to make something that would not be a lecture about consent, but a conversation about consent. I wanted to make something that would not be, again, the binary of yes and no. I mean, where there's a binary, there is some, one should pause and look, you know, like what's hidden inside the binaries. So between the yes and no sense of maybe, I think was important, because as we know now that the idea of consent is also sometimes used to force you to decide right away for everything in an absolute fashion. It's too legalistic, and there is a lot more complexity in the way people engage with each other, and people have done it. It's not like people are incapable of doing it. In fact, reducing it to yes and no increases your incapacity rather than strengthening your muscle for listening and paying attention to people. So, and of course, I was very lucky that I saw the Lavani performance, because my friends Savitri and Bhushan had been working with Lavani dancers. And then I asked them, should we collaborate and do this video? And the thing is that we also didn't want the binary of men and women, that men are the aggressors and women don't feel desire, because that is woven into a lot of conversation about sex and consent. Women don't actually want it. I didn't ask for it. I, you know, that sort of thing. And men have to somehow get consent from women, right? So I think that we also need to take away this kind of a conversation and make it about exchange. What's the word we use consent for now, but maybe we want to start using more and more words. Like, maybe we want to expand the conversation. And I think feminism always does that, that eventually it expands the conversation so much that your starting point is no longer valid because you have reached elsewhere now, you know. So I think that, for example, the in-between section, the in-between verse of Consent Lavani, where she says no when she means yes. Now, this is something that men always say, right? Like those in naam e haan hai, and that sort of thing. The thing is, do we, in the interests of talking about violence, which is very important, in the interests of telling people that it's wrong to assume what people mean, do we want to end up stigmatizing pleasure? Do we want to end up stigmatizing sex? Do we want to end up saying that people never teasingly say no when they mean yes? And most of all, do we want to accept the masculine version of that occurrence? What if we say, yes, you're right. Women sometimes do say no when they may say yes, but have you asked them why they do it? Because nobody asks them. You just pass judgment on it. So we told that story, but we told it from the woman's point of view. And she says that, well, I was scared that if I say yes, he'll think I'm a fast girl. I will lose all my agency. the moment that I say yes. I'm trying to retain some sense of control in the situation, which is outside of my control, actually. And I think that was empathetic to all concerned, right? So it eased up the conversation a lot.
Just to add to that, what I kept thinking when I was watching that video was also this, that if men don't understand consent, there is also the part that women also don't know how to exactly state it. So there
express
is
it,
the whole, because it's also a game, right? Like the wooing is not so directly an exchange of, yes and no, but there is that little bit of, the whole, I don't know. Like,
and I also want to ask one question, like the men who don't get consent, do they really not get it? Of course they get it. Do they not know what they're doing is wrong? Of course they know it. They are choosing not to hear. Also, men, not just men, the whole world is educated not to listen to women.
Yeah.
I'm very happy I went to girls' colleges because it just taught me to take women seriously and thereby to take myself seriously. And I think that this imbues every aspect of our lives. I mean, as a woman, frankly, at the end of 5 years of doing something as radical as Agents of Ishq, I'll still never be on the cover of a magazine. But let a man do even 1/10 of this, 1/125th of what, 1/2500th of what we've done, and he'll be seen as a radical guy, right? So I feel like this dichotomy is a weight that we carry, and we always have to struggle more to make ourselves heard. So there is a habit of not listening to women that really needs to be questioned. And I think that when you say good manners, this puts the onus on everybody.
Yes. Right?
It tells them, you know what good manners are. So why don't you think about good manners when you are being, it's all about how you behave with other people, right? Giving them space while asking for what you want, right? So when you go into somebody's house and you want a glass of water, you don't just go into there to use the consent like a cup of tea type of analogy. You ask them, can I please have a glass of water, right? So the thing is that these ideas of good manners make us think about the theme differently without defenses. But I have to say that the sexual etiquette column came about in a very interesting way, which is that because we were doing so many different things about consent, because our conversation about consent was not unitary or binary, but kept on looking at multiple spaces and multiple ways of thinking about consent. And in fact, after Me Too, we did a collaboration with the Lady's Finger in which we put out a call to ask women for their most memorable sexual experience, good, bad, or indifferent. Because we wanted to say that women have a number of different sexual experiences. We actually did it right after the Aziz Ansari incident, because we wanted to, not Aziz Ansari, what's his name, the comic?
Aziz Ansari.
Aziz Ansari, yes.
Yeah.
So the Aziz Ansari
incident. This is the one that came out in
Babe.net.
Babe.net, yes.
So, but because we wanted to say that, women deal with things in different ways and they should have that right to decide. I don't think that, during Me Too, everybody wanted every woman to file a police case. But maybe every woman doesn't want to file a police case. Maybe some women are like, it was horrible. I was traumatized for a bit. I have processed it in this way and I'm moving past. Or somebody else wants an apology. I mean, people want a number of different things and nobody's ever asking the women what it is that they might want. They always decide to punish the men. All the effort when we talk about these things has to be to take it out of the domain of morality and into the domain of life, right? Into the domain of relationality. So because we had been doing so many things, and when we did this series X, actually, we got 100 accounts from women about their most memorable sexual experience. And it immediately diversified the conversation, right? Because I think that the great contribution of Me Too, other than throwing up the tremendous sexism that women face on a day-to-day basis, also for the first time in public space, there was a granularity with which women were talking about sex openly. It was all bad stuff, but it was the actual stuff. And I would say that other than Agents of Ishq, there hadn't been a space where people actually spoke about the everyday business of sex, like actually how sex happens. And that was always my problem, that it's sexuality and never sex when people talk about it. So what actually happens, it always remains shrouded, right? And so finally it started to come out in such a way and you understood the kind of things that were happening between people. They were about sexism. They were about just being rude, like really discourteous to other human beings.
Bad behavior.
Right? Yeah, and acceptance of that bad behavior and hating yourself for that. There were so many things that were happening there. So these multiple conversations that we started having on Agents of Ish led to many, many people writing to us with very granular questions. So questions would always be, and I think that was a great, like it, I counted it as an accomplishment of what that conversation was, because it took a long time, that suddenly people were no longer asking abstract questions like consent or no consent, but were saying, now, if I look at a girl on the bus who I think is attractive, how does that violate her consent? And you can explain that it violates if you do this and doesn't violate if you do that, right? So the fact that people began to think about their own behavior and started asking us, I think is a positive sign. And I really don't like it when other like woke spaces, you know, heap contempt on a person who asks that question. For me, the fact that they asked it means they had a doubt about it. And that is also why our sex ed column is called Small Doubts, because it's that, ma'am, I have a small doubt, which people ask in class, right? But it is that thing that suddenly you have a moment of doubt, where before you just were like, of course, what's wrong? That's how the world is. Now you're saying, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Should I or should I not be doing this, right? So they're writing to us. And so then we just thought, it's about etiquette. Like, this is not about, we are not here, we're not agony aunties. We can't actually tell you how to feel better. That's a therapist's job, or, you know. But we can have a conversation about how we behave with each other. So that is how the sexual etiquette column came about.
In the 5 years, do you also feel that, you know, the way young people are, you know, expressing, because a lot of writers, like most of them, are also young people who are writing to you and who are also sharing their stories. Do you see a way in which they're also expressing and talking about themselves, like from when you started out with Agents of Ish?
I think yes, you know, in that sense, Agents of Ish is like a kind of perennial research project, because when it started, we didn't really anticipate. We thought we would produce everything because we were thinking like filmmakers. So we'd produce all the content.
Yeah.
But because we very playfully said to people, do you want to be an Agent of Ish? Then write to us. And people took that literally and wrote saying, I also want to be an Agent of Ish. The exciting thing was that, again, for everybody, what it means to be an Agent of Wish was a different thing, right? They all interpreted it their way. So it was kind of exciting. And it, within a few days, people started writing saying, I want to contribute my story. And they saw it as a space where things that they had been speaking about, maybe to a friend, maybe to nobody, could be present, sure. But in essence, what it's done in these 5 years is that it has made the site into a co-created space. And as a documentary filmmaker, I think this is great, because you always struggle with what does it mean to work with other people's reality in documentary. And it's a very racked kind of ethical area, to be honest, you know. And although I love making documentaries, just always discomforted me, because I can't bear not to have my creative voice or my perspective in there. But I'm also aware that we're talking to other people about their lives. So on Agents of Ish, the fact that people contribute their stories but can be anonymous if they want, that we work with them to make it into something more artistic so that it's not just like spitting out a clickbaity confession. That's quite important, but it also has reshaped the site as we've gone along, right? Because it depends on what concerns they're bringing up. So right in the beginning, I think the people who wrote in were people who were already thinking about these things a little bit more openly, and they were happy to be able to have a space in which to express it. So there was a certain kind of radicalism. Like now when I see the early narratives, I feel like, would we dare to put this out now? Because the space has become a lot more stressful. Like there's a lot more censorship from social media and a lot more trolling. But at that time, it's pretty amazing. We had some really, really incredibly frank pieces that came in. Over time, I think that the diversified and become far broader. So the good thing is that now we are reaching an audience that is not, you know, already a little bit more awake to these issues, but who are much younger. Our audience has become younger. More men have entered the audience. People who are not English speaking are in the audience. We are getting direct Hindi contributions from people. So all this is extremely important. And I think that the shift that is showing is that people are speaking about their intimate lives in a much more integrated fashion. Right? They are talking about this kind of cross-section of love and sex and desire and culture and politics and family and whatnot. I think definitely all these conversations, from Me Too to however limited the conversation on consent, all of those conversations have made a difference. And people are much more aware of the different possibilities compared to, there are a larger number of people who are aware. But what it's also done is, you know, it has thrown up many more, of course, stories about trauma. It has also revealed that there are a lot of people still who don't know that much. So we now have more questions like, can I get pregnant if this thing happens? You know, so far more tentative world. But I see that as a positive thing. It means that people who wouldn't ever have entered this space are entering that space. So we see that shift over time. We've seen a lot of, surfacing of mental health questions. Emotional resilience was always a very strong part of what we did. And I think it's good that we did it because it becomes a kind of invitation to talk about these things. Perhaps we were not looking at mental health as a theme, you know, to be honest. We were looking at it like we want to integrate mind, body, heart type of thing. But the moment that you do that, it's so interesting what comes out. So then in the last about, I would say 3 years, focus on mental health and what we call mental sexual health has increased. And you are seeing a lot of narratives about that coming in, where people are talking about their mental health as a result of the difficulties of their sexual lives or the complexities of sexual lives. But also seeing another very interesting thing, I think it's a very important thing, that more and more young women especially are understanding the interlinkages between political attitudes or like cultural attitudes and their mental health. So for example, you might get a narrative where women will talk about how we have been shamed for talking about sex. So even if we are sexually free, we feel a certain amount of shame deep inside. This makes us unable to really ask for what we want in relationships. So we get a little bit badly treated, then we hate ourselves some more, and it becomes a cycle and it causes depression. So you're seeing people articulate this much more than before. And I think that's a good thing. Like if you're able to pinpoint this, you have some hope of changing it a little bit. And the thing is that every time somebody shares such a narrative online, other people then respond to it or they send a narrative of their own. So that's how actually the conversation starts growing in front of your eyes. The other thing is that Instagram, although it's got some horrible new guidelines and there's more and more censorship on Facebook and Instagram, which makes life tough for us, but it allows this really interesting feature of asking a question, the answer to which only we would know who has given, right? So, but when we share it in public, it's anonymous. And that gives people a lot of interesting freedom as well as a personalized feeling that, well, they trust us. So that's great that there's a lot of trust for Agents of Irish. And I think it is because we research everything and there's a very personal quality to everything, right? It's not disembodied. But we'll ask a question like, what is the thing that stops you from asking for love if you want it, for example? And these very honest questions, honest answers will emerge. And those answers, we will know your name if you answer. But then when it's shared in public, it's anonymous. So it gives the person a feeling that I told somebody what I felt and they saw me, right? And well, then what I said is also part of the public discourse. But this partial anonymity, as I call it, I think has been really productive for us. So in that, we have seen a lot of emotional questions. There's an entire emotional world of sex that really needs to be tackled along with the informational world of sex, right? The third thing I would say is that there are a number of people who have now begun to write to us saying that I was 18 when I found your site, but I'm 23 now, so I kind of grew up with you. And that often makes me at least feel a little weepy because I think, you know, there are older people who say, I wish I had had Agents of Irish when I was young. But now there are people who've had that 5 years. Like, actually, we did make a difference in those lives in a very concrete way. And for somebody who believes that you can't count whether you can make a difference or not, like as an artist, you just have to do it and believe that it will make a difference in the world. It's overwhelming and exciting to see that, yes, you can make a difference to people as long as you're not deciding what that difference should be, right? You're really trying to give them as much as they can to help, but you're not doing it in that very like self-sacrificing, main tulsi tere aangan ki, because I'm definitely not that. I mean, there is a strong, like we have a strong belief system. There are many things that are not allowed on Agents of Irish. We won't take certain types of narratives. We don't take anything. The word problematic has never been used on Agents of Irish. It's not allowed. And, you know, so there are many strong positions that we take. And we don't, for example, have any culture, hardly any cultural commentary. We have no opinion pieces. It's all experiential. So there is definitely a strong artistic and political assertion that we two are making. But that's just saying, this is what I believe. But it's not forcing other people to believe that. And I think that's been very important to have the chance. And that's where the internet is a great space for that. That you have the chance to iterate, reiterate, change, keep shifting in relationship, like consent, like etiquette. You're constantly shifting in relationship to your audience. Sometimes you're doing things that you might not yourself have thought of doing or wanted to do, because it has emerged. The audience has expressed itself to you. And I think as an artist or as a feminist, one of the trainings you get is learning to read between the lines. It's also the training you need for consent in a way, right?
Yes.
So that when you look at people's responses and you read between the lines and you intuit, I think people want to know about this and you create material for that. And then the continuous dance of give and take that keeps shaping the space and making it a community. I think we have seen definitely that a shift is occurring, and that young people, because there are more and more spaces now growing, right? Which are sexuality education focused. There is some kind of an awareness that we need to give young people something else other than aspirational ideas. What is a life skill? How should we define what we need to live life? I think that there is some thinking going on. And what is remarkable is that even in a few short years, 5 or 7, 8 years that this thinking has been going on, it has made an impact. I think that other people you speak to who work with young people would also say this. There are a lot of troubles, but yeah, there's also changes.
So what's in store for Agents of Ishq now from here? Now she's turned 5. So yeah, now what's coming?
Go to school. Go to school. I keep saying that Agents of Ishq, never thought it would go on for so long. We thought we would do the project for 2 years, you know. And then it has kept growing and growing. And I always say it's like a very fat baby that's sitting on my lap and won't get up. And now it's time for it to go to school. So it should leave me alone a bit type of thing. I think one thing is that in these 5 years, I think we needed these 5 years to do the work that we do, to understand the work itself. I think that it's not often that people are given the chance to do that, unfortunately. You're always in this current world supposed to know the meaning of a thing before it has happened, right? You're supposed to know what relationship you want on Tinder to put in your bio before you've met any person. And the idea that you might want something different with different people is just not part of the thing. So in that context, to have had these 5-6 years on Agents of Ishq to experiment and to learn through the experimentation, I think now at the end of this time, we have understood certain things really work. They can be put into practice in a more regularized, systematic way. Maybe these are famous last words, but it doesn't all have to be done in that kind of artistic intensity where we are doing on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, I think like Agents of Ishq's strength and weakness is that it is a very strongly creative project. It is not actually in that sense a didactic project. But the problem with creative projects is that they're continuously artisanal and they're continuously inventive. They're not in that sense systematized. So I think, but now there is a time has come where we have about 500 pieces of content. So, you know, to consolidate that in some way, to create modules that people can use, I think we'll have a new website up next year. A little bit easier to search. Especially for people who are looking, it's going to be tagged differently so that different things that have been talked about on the site over time, which is not just topics that we think people should think about, but topics people are thinking about, so that there may be a large, like, you know, for example, asexuality. Now that is something people have written about and it comes up more and more. So it has become a thread. So similarly, body positivity, mental health, all of these things. So it will be tagged in a way that will be easier to find with these topics. And I think what we're going to do is create modules that take into account that people who deliver sex education also didn't have sex education, and that they do have, there's an actual problem for parents who want to do their best also. They need a little helping hand. So to create modules that are actually helpful to the person delivering the module in how to deal with certain things. So this is some of the stuff that we're going to be putting out. We're also going to be doing in the next year a series of talks to define what is sex education. You know, like from a multifaceted point of view. So not a series of, like, I feel, again, the stuff about sex education that's been out there has been, it's too childish to only speak about it in terms of curriculum, you know. It has to be a philosophical approach. So we want to do a series of...
There are people sleeping in a sex ed class, as you rightly mentioned. Really, yeah. You know, it needs a rehaul.
Yeah. So, but also, I mean, the idea of education itself, right? What is education itself is something that really we need to talk about a lot more. And so we want to do a series of talks next year, which will be about looking at sex education from a philosophical standpoint and like reinvigorating that field with some abstract thinking, which has been a little bit missing. I feel like from the, you know, there have been some early feminist approaches to sex education, which have been radical and awesome. But then it has all become a little bit domesticated. And the need to radicalize and non-domesticate it, to make it like more politically and creatively meaningful to people, it requires a philosophical engagement. It can't be a very functional engagement. So we want to try to do a series of talks that will form like a kind of thinking about it. So we will be looking at who are the people that we can talk to about it. We'll also be doing much more like bringing a lot of the new thinking around sexuality, like on our Instagram live. So we'll be doing a few more of those kinds of things. But of course, yes, continuing to make a lot of content. And we're also engaging with, you know, the Udaya study, the Population Council. Okay. Oh, the Population Council has done a huge longitudinal study of young people in UP and Bihar. And it's a really fascinating study. So they did it over a 4-year period, looking at people from 10 to 14 and I guess 18 to 22, but they went back and interviewed the same cohort after 4 years, right? To see where they were, what their aspirations are. So we're going to be engaging with some of that data to create some materials as well. So yeah, a more systematized, but hopefully not less fun time ahead for us.
So it, clearly Agents of Ishq is going in for some rigorous school.
Yes. Yes, we are going to school.
Yeah, you are going to school for sure. But thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. So I mean, I would have loved to actually ask you one last question. Maybe I will.
Sure. Yes.
Tell us more about Shah Rukh Khan and Agents of Ishq. Has Shah Rukh Khan inspired you to do something with it?
Shah Rukh Khan has not inspired Agents of Ishq, I regret to say, but Shah Rukh Khan does inspire many things that I do.
No, but I definitely see some bit of that in the way you talk about, you know, his idea of Mehman Nawazi and charm, which a lot about that, this openness, which is why, I mean, I couldn't resist it.
I love Shah Rukh because I love those things. And it's not so much the other. I think that when people love a movie star, they are responding to certain archetypal things that and a world, a life and a world that they believe in. And I guess I do think that Shah Rukh Khan's entire persona of holding out his arms and saying that, you know, take me in your arms, I will take you in my arms. We don't know. That ambiguity is the beauty of it somewhere, right? But I think, yes, there's an Indianness about Shah Rukh Khan, which I like very much, which I relate to. And that Mehman Nawazi, that hospitality, that kindness, along with mischief, along with a kind of egalitarianism, you know, somewhere, I think that there are a lot of those qualities that definitely infuse Agents of Ishq. So I would say that Agents of Ishq is the Shah Rukh Khan of sex ed sites in that sense.
So, thank you very much. I mean, I think it's a great note to end on. And for everyone else who's listening, please do check into the Shah Rukh Khan of Sex Ed, which is Agents of Ishq. You can find their work on agentsofishq.com. They're also there on Instagram. You can also find them on Twitter. And please also, please also watch Paromita Vohra's earlier works, which, and I would definitely personally recommend Where Sandra and Unlimited Girls for anyone who's interested in feminism, pleasure, gender, and urban culture. And
thank you
very much. Thank you so much, Paromita.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.